Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runners, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Welcome to Babbittville Radio. My name is Bob Babbitt. We are brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series, by VeloFix.com, RunCatalina.com, the Catalina Island Marathon, the 40th anniversary coming up on Saturday, March 11th. Our Challenged Athletes Foundation, we've raised over $80 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Definitely check us out on iTunes or on Babbittville.com and subscribe to our Endurance World newsletter. Our next guest, Mr. Mike Coots, was just out here at the Adaptive Surfing World Championships. Mike, how are you?
I'm doing great. Aloha from Hawaii.
Aloha to yourself, man. Hey, so you grew up on the island of Kauai?
I did, correct. Born and raised here.
Okay, and you started surfing, I'm assuming, basically as soon as you could find your way to the beach.
Yep, basically in my diapers, heading in the water. I don't even honestly remember when I started.
And
I must have been pretty young.
Yeah. Any other sports? Just one of those guys who played pretty much everything?
No, just pretty much anything in the water. Swimming, diving, surfing, fishing, boating. Yeah, I was pretty much a water baby growing up all the way through high school. Not really into organized sports as much. It was more just water sports.
So 17 years old, 1997, actually 20 years ago. Coming up on an anniversary. So we all know that when we go out in the ocean, we're basically visitors, right? You know, somebody else lives there. We're visiting, and hopefully we're going to be okay. This particular time, were you surfing or bodyboarding? What were you doing?
I was bodyboarding. I was an avid bodyboarder at that time in my life, right out of high school, and it was kind of like a day like today, just absolutely beautiful in those days. You're like, wow, I really live in paradise. And sun was coming up, not a cloud in the sky, and just basically just any other gorgeous day, paddle out with friends, and didn't really get a chance to catch a wave. Started paddling for a nice one, and out of nowhere, a tiger shark came underneath me, grabbed onto me, and basically bit my leg off right then and there.
I remember talking to your parents. I was talking to your folks over at the CAF building a little while ago, and they were saying, you know, the shark actually had both legs in his mouth.
Yep.
And Mike, you know, hit the shark and lost. You got bit in the finger from that. But if you hadn't have done that, you would have had both legs bit off.
Very good chance. It was one of those fight or flight moments. I think, you know, it's not like you remember an article you read in Outside Magazine of what to do when you get attacked by a shark. It was that very primitive, you know, got to do anything and everything to get this creature away from me. And that involved, I punching it. And I think it helped, you know, freak the shark out and get it away from me. And it disappeared back underwater right as I hit it. And in retrospect, it was a smart thing to do at the time.
So, but when you first looked down, you saw the blood, and your finger was cut. So you thought that was from your finger, and when did you notice the leg?
Honestly, I looked at my finger. I got back on my board. I punched it a couple times. It let go. I got back on my board, and I looked at my finger, and it looked like, I guess, like a potato would, like, split open. I could see the bone and tissue, and I was like, wow, you know, at that point in my life, I'd never seen that much blood, and it was like, oh, I'm hurt, and I better get in, and this, you know, I could lose my finger, and I was, you know, kind of everything was worried about my finger, and I started paddling in, and as I was paddling, you know, you're in your prone position, you're not behind you, and I felt this weird vibration in my limb, in my right leg, and I was like, huh, maybe the shark's coming back to get me. It was this crazy, uncontrollable spasm, weird shake, and I looked over my shoulder, and I thought, here it is, the jaws coming right at me, and it wasn't a shark, it was my leg perfectly amputated off. Like a surgeon could not have done a better job. I had no idea in the shark attack itself that it came off. I just felt pressure, but no pain, and the shark did a really clean cut of my foot. It was completely bitten off right down the middle of my shin, and it was doing that, you know, squirting blood, I think, when your heart beats.
Oh, yeah.
A couple feet in the air doing that full blood squirting. And then it was like, now I'm really hurt. And luckily, I didn't have time to really, you know, dwell on the thought too much. A little wave came right up to me, and I caught it and rode it right up to the sand. And I tried standing up, I guess. You know, you're used to having 2 feet your whole
sure.
life. And without a foot, you can't stand. And I fell over, and my friends were quick thinking, and they all came up to my aid and dragged me a little higher up the stand and made a tourniquet with my leash. And a guy saw it from a bit away and took his truck on the stand, threw it in 4x4, and they threw me in the bed of his pickup truck, and we went to the emergency room.
So,
it was one of those things. Like, it was a surreal,
yeah,
almost like an out-of-body experience, I guess. Like, I was in a movie watching it happen to somebody else without any pain, just a lot of weird pressure. And then, obviously, in the back of the truck, I started going in and out of shock, getting really hot, really cold, really hot over and over. But it wasn't a painful event. It wasn't a scary event. It was just this weird, surreal moment that happened really fast, and I guess it changed my life forever. And in retrospect, it was the best thing that ever happened to me in a weird way.
Why would you say that? The best thing that ever happened to you?
Because, I mean, you know, life goes in its own way, and a lot of things are dictated, I guess, by situations in your life. And it's brought me a lot of wonderful people into my life, and a lot of wonderful travels and experiences, and just being able to help others and similar situations, I felt real value in that in my life, and I attribute a lot, you know, to the shark attack and those situations around it. But I wouldn't change anything. You know, if I had to go paddle back out that day, knowing I would get attacked and lose a limb, I would still paddle out. Absolutely.
Wow. So when you wake up in the hospital, and I'm assuming that they had they have to do obviously some surgery to close things up. You knew at that point your leg was gone.
It was kind of a funny thing, because I got sent to our main hospital out of that pickup truck, and then I got to the main hospital. My body sort of gave out as soon as I got medical help. The doctor put his arm on my shoulders, and I remember, you know, you kind of just hang on until you come, you know, get help, and my body sort of gave out, and I went unconscious. And it was about, I think, 24 hours or so, I woke up, and I was post-surgery, and I'm... You know, I come to in this, like, sort of groggy state, and I've got my family and friends all around me, and I remember my mother looking at the surgeon looking at my mother in this really sort of somber, quiet, sad state, and the doctor goes, well, do you want to tell him? Or my mom's like, yeah, I'll tell him, and Mike, you know, you're missing your leg. And I was like, yeah, guys, I saw it come off.
Everybody started
cheering, and then it was like hugs, and it was like this real uplifting moment. And I think they were really afraid that I didn't know that it came off, and I was going to be, you know, going into instant depression. And I honestly woke up in that hospital room happy to be alive and happy to have survived it, and seeing, you know, all these family and friends all around me, it wasn't that big of a deal at all. I think it was harder on my family than it was myself.
You know what's interesting, from talking to a lot of challenge athletes over the years, when it comes from trauma, and I've heard this over and over again, that the people around you are sort of, they take their lead from you, right? In terms of until you're good, they really can't move on with their life. And that's a tough thing for especially a young man to deal with. But how long was it before you felt that, okay, it's, you know, this is a new life, this is a new me, it's time to move on?
It's almost like there's these weird little subchapters of little pivotal moments, but the very first one would have been right there, you know, when my mother told me that I was an amputee, and I told her, I know, and it's okay. That, you know, that was moment one, and that was something, okay, now we get on to this new chapter in life, and it was, you know, it wasn't this real sad moment, it was just this life goes on moment. And then about 3 days later, I was visited in the hospital by a man wearing pants, and he came and, you know, chatted for 5 minutes or so and left. And my mother looked at me and, like, you know, you've got a prosthetic leg. And it was like, prosthetic leg? I had no idea, you know, being on this little island, and you're pretty isolated here in the Pacific, and I hadn't even heard that term in my life, or I had, you know, yet to see a prosthetic leg. And I think it was like this little light switch in my head that, well, I'm going to have a device that'll help me get around and walk around. And that was another, you know, that was chapter two, this little other pivotal moment, you know, okay, now this is kind of exciting. There's technology out there that will help me do, you know, do my passions, and maybe even help me surf again, or get in the water, or any, you know, or go hiking. And it's these little moments, you know, and then you sort of build on that, and you get your first prosthetic leg, and then it's like, okay, I've got this leg, but I can't really, what can I do with it? And, you know, and can't really do much with it, you think, and you're, you know, and then you get in a truck and you drive a stick shift truck for the first time, and you're like, wow, this, I can actually do that, you know, and you kind of build on these little pivotal little things that are kind of trivial to most people. But I think, you know, as you're starting this new chapter in your life with this bit of carbon and plastic and titanium, and you figure out ways of overcoming these little things, that it kind of builds the self-confidence in a way that, you know, you kind of get comfortable being uncomfortable, and you kind of figure out how to adapt and change and do things a little differently. But in the end, you know, you're on the road with everybody else driving around, or you're hiking the trails with everybody else, getting, you know, maybe you've got to adapt a little bit, but you're right there alongside all these other able-bodied people, and it's pretty cool in a weird little way.
So when this type of thing happens to a lot of people, there's anger, right? That shark, and we got to get rid of all the sharks.
Yep.
And you are somebody who's always been into the preservation of sharks and protecting the sharks. And obviously that became more of an issue for you after you lost your leg. But talk a little bit about some of the work that you've done to try to protect the species.
We've had a bit of a debate here in our state of Hawaii, because we've got a really strong long lining industry and a really strong fishing industry. And about 7 years ago, there was a bill up for vote, and it was basically to stop. People would go out and they'd kill sharks and use their fins, and it gets sold overseas for shark fin soup. It's a bit of a
delicacy,
sort of a status symbol in Asia. And because Hawaii is pretty much the closest, you know, landmass to Asia and America, a lot of those long line boats would come over here and they would catch sharks and take the fins back to Asia, and we wanted to put a stop to that. So we created the first bill of its kind in America that banned all shark fin products. And it basically became like contraband, like you had drugs or something.
Right.
You're in possession of any shark product whatsoever. And we saw that our fisheries didn't collapse here, you know, the fish markets didn't collapse, that life sort of still went on, and other states saw that. And soon enough, California, you know, your state had a shark fin ban, and New York and Oregon and Florida. So it kind of just, we built on this movement of this state bill here in Hawaii. And I've been fortunate to sort of use the irony of my shark attack and join up with marine scientists and go to, I've gone to Washington and spoken to our senators about creating stronger federal bills. I've done the same thing at the United Nations and talking to international sort of leaders in their countries and creating marine sanctuaries and having countries partner with other countries that are neighboring countries and create these large swaths of MPA, basically marine protected areas that are totally hands-off on shark fishing. And it's starting to work. I think we're starting to realize that large protected areas, because sharks are such, you know, long-swimming pelagic fish, that you kind of need for them a little bit bigger areas for it to be effective. And it's been fun, you know, seeing politics, you know, work firsthand, and in my case, a very, I guess, positive view on politics, because we were able to get these bills passed, and it's been a bit, you know, exciting time, obviously, in the Capitol or, you know, in New York at the United Nations building and meeting with, you know, people that are passionate about the ocean and learning all the science behind it and policy change before my eyes. It's a pretty cool thing.
That is really cool. And how long was it after you lost your leg before you were back in the ocean?
I was physically back in the ocean as soon as the staples came out, the stitches all, you know, came out. And I think that was maybe 3.5 weeks or so after the shark attack. I was back bodyboarding in it, and I happened to go back out sort of right in the same area I got attacked at. And it wasn't, you know, trying to get back on the horse in the same pasture or anything like that. It just happened the waves were good that day at the same area. So we went, I ended up jumping back in the water for the first time right where I got attacked. And there was no scariness or anything like that.
So no, when you were out there hearing the music or anything?
No, nothing like, no job, music queuing up. As soon as I walked in the water now. And it was just, you know, we get these beautiful days in Hawaii, like the day I got attacked and like the day it is today. And it's like, I don't know, you live here, you've got to enjoy the ocean. It's so hard to put into words, but when the water's that blue and the sun is out and it's clear.
It's the best. I know.
It's the best. It's one of those good things of all life, you know.
And I remember when you were here for the Adaptive Surfing Championship, I'm pretty sure there was like, what, two or three or four of you guys who all lost your legs to sharks?
Yep, correct. There was a great white attack. There was another team member, Colin Cook, who got attacked by a tiger shark here on Oahu pretty recently, about a year and a half ago, or even maybe it might have been a little over a year ago. And he got fourth in the AS2 division. But, yeah, there was three or four of us, shark attack survivors from around the world. And there's even quite a bit of shark attack survivors who are advocates for the protection of sharks.
I bet.
Yeah, it's something that, you know, maybe had I been a visitor in Hawaii and stuck my toes in the water at Waikiki Beach and a shark came out and attacked me, it'd be a little different feeling. But day in and day out, my entire life in the ocean and learning about the ocean and the marine ecosystem in the ocean, is you really sort of develop a special bond with Mother Nature and with our seas. And I think it's a similar trait amongst other shark attack survivors who have spent a lot of time in the water. There's no hatred for the, you know, for sharks.
Back in the day, if somebody was an amputee, they basically was surfing on one leg, right? They're really a prosthetic leg made of carbon fiber. Wasn't something you were supposed to get salt water on.
Nope.
Now it seems like there's been a huge step forward in the equipment. Is that a fair read?
Absolutely. When I first was curious about taking my prosthetic in the ocean, I did a Google search, and I think there was maybe one image on all of Google of somebody surfing with a prosthetic. If that, there was no website, there was nothing out there. And now you look online, and there's a lot of information, and there's a lot of, you know, athletes around the world that are adapting in their own way, whether they've got a, you know, above the knee prosthetic, a below the knee prosthetic, or regular foot, goofy foot, what kind of boards they're riding. Everybody's kind of got their own way that they do it, and that's what's really cool about social media and being in such an information age, that everything is out there, and you can ask questions, and you can reach people, and if something breaks, you can find out how to fix it, really, you know, and it's nice. It's no better time to be an amputee than right here, right now, that's for sure.
What I loved is last summer and then again this winter, we had the Adaptive Surfing Championships here in La Jolla. And with the Olympics now accepting surfing in for 2020, I'm imagining that either 2020 or 2024, there's a good chance that surfing could be in the Paralympics. You mentioned this is a great era to be an amputee, but how cool would that be?
That I think for every adaptive surfer in the world, that's our dream, is to one day represent our country, you know, on that world stage at an Olympic venue. That would be a very exciting day. And if that day were to come, I would do everything in my powers to make sure I'm the best possible athlete I can to represent Team USA. I think that's the holy grail of adaptive surfing. And I think Fernando and the ISA, and they're doing a really great thing.
They are.
I think it's a matter of time. I really do. I think it's a matter of time before adaptive surfing is in the Paralympics.
The other thing that's great about that is the competition. Because usually when a sport gets going, you've got a splattering of athletes in different parts of the world. But when something becomes, you know, World Adaptive Surfing Championship, I think CAF brought in, I don't know, 60 athletes or something for the summer event. The competition is pretty fierce, and the competition is deeper than ever before, don't you think?
Even this last year at the World Adaptive Surfing Championship, it seemed like it was twice as competitive, and everybody was twice as focused, I think it's really just going to build on that, and I think as more amputees learn about adaptive surfing, it's a great cross training too, just for life being an amputee, that you're in the water and you now don't have gravity. You know, your surfing is 90% paddling. You don't have this gravity pulling you down. You can kind of express yourself in your own unique way, and you can get away from the sort of the stairs and all that on land, and you're in your own element. I think surfing is a really good thing for amputees to do, and I think as more and more people hear about adaptive surfing in all these, you know, far-flung countries, that teams will get stronger, teams will get bigger, and there'll just be more competition amongst ourselves.
Where's the coolest place you've surfed in terms of your travels?
Um, Good question. I would say the coldest and most different would be Iceland.
Oh, my God. How cold was that?
That's pretty cold. And especially, you know, coming straight from a plane in Hawaii. Oh. That was cold, and it's ice cream headaches in it. It's all that. But the sheer beauty of it's incredible, and just the people of Iceland and the scenery. It's a really cool place. I've surfed inside a sea cave. That's been pretty cool.
Wow.
A bit different. We have some really cool sea caves here in Hawaii. I stand-up paddled against lava flowing into the ocean up the Big Island. That was a bit surreal. That was a few months back.
Yeah.
Not probably the smartest thing to do, but it was pretty neat, to say the least. You can feel the heat of the lava as it enters the ocean, and this plume of all these different gases and just the beauty of it. And we went really, you know, first light where the lava, it's more pronounced, that glow, because the full day sun hasn't hit it.
Right.
It's one of those just really beautiful, cool things on Earth to do.
So you're also a photographer.
Yep.
And is most of your photography surf related?
Early on it was, and it was a bit of that those first few 6 months or a year after the shark attack, I had a lot of downtime. As my body started to heal, and I got fitted with prosthetics, and a lot of my close friends are professional surfers, and that's sort of how I got my start in photography, was shooting my friends surfing, and that love kind of just grew from there. And recently, I found myself shooting more advertising work of lifestyle and models and resorts.
Uh-huh.
I guess it's a bit challenging, and the money's good, and it's you know, cool situations, and you meet some really cool people, and I just enjoy the challenge. It's constant problem solving, and you know, at the end of the day, you felt like you've overcome 1,000 problems to, you know, to create this result, and I enjoy the challenge.
So last year, I think it was last year, you did the Empire State Run-Up. I mean, you've done some other stuff, right? Some ground-related stuff. Talk a little bit about that. Here's a surfer boy from Kauai in New York running up the Empire State Building with a prosthetic leg. That's a little different.
That was a bit different. And I had about 3 or 4 months to train. And obviously on a little island, if you don't have any staircase like the Empire State Building, but we did have an old decapitated staircase next to Principal Hotel that is about 40 years old, and I believe there's about 100 stairs, and it's a staircase that goes to nowhere. So it's kind of a mountain hill.
And every
morning and afternoon I would just run these stairs in the hot sun, and I'm like, okay, that was what 100th of what the Empire State Building's gonna be like. but it was fun, and it was one of those experiences where you're just like, how cool was that when you're done doing it, and you sort of feel this, you know, sense of accomplishment, and it really feels like this, you know, this goal that's very high up there, and it's just something very different, and nothing I'm used to, and it was really cool to do, and it's really cool to, you know, to think about it, and reflect on it.
So, and I'm assuming this happens fairly often, because you're a pretty easy guy to get a hold of. Do you hear from a lot of families whose son or daughter has lost a leg or lost an arm, and you know, they're looking to you to sort of be that role model or give them a message. Is that something that happens fairly often?
Yeah, and it kind of goes back to that story, the second chapter that happened to me when I was in the hospital, and that guy visited me wearing pants.
Yeah.
I remember how that was such a pivotal moment, and I really felt like this sort of, you know, new step, a new chapter, a new vision in my life. And it was because that guy spent 3 minutes with me or so, 5 minutes in the hospital.
Yeah.
Oh, that was such a profound impact in my life that, you know, right when I needed it the most, this guy comes out of nowhere and visits me. And I really try to pay that forward. And I do know that those early moments after something so traumatic and you're in the hospital and you have all these questions and will my life be the same? And will I be able to, you know, take care of my 2-year-old, or am I able to go grocery shopping, or am I going to make up the staircase in my home, you know, and all these questions, and I really try to be a peer-to-peer sort of mentor during those critical days or weeks or months right after, you know, a traumatic amputation. And it's sort of this, back to this information era, that now everybody can be reached really easily, and I can be linked up with, you know, these small degrees of separation around the world, and there is a shark attack or somebody loses in a car accident, you know,
right,
a limb, an arm, a leg in a car accident. You can really connect with somebody on a personal basis very quickly, you know, after something happened or Holland on our Hawaii surf team, you know, he got attacked by a shark, and 20 minutes after he got attacked, I already have his phone number. I know what hospital he's going to be at. I know what room he's in. And 3 hours later, we're chatting over the phone as he comes out of surgery. It's sort of it's a unique time, I guess, to be an amputee and to be able to reach to people and help people and you know, give little glimpses of hope. And that's what I like about, I guess, the social media thing is indirectly I can sort of reach people with photos that I take of myself surfing with my prosthetic leg and a real, you know, vision-oriented putting on the table that this could be you, or this in 6 months with this prosthetic and this, you know, training, you can be doing this. And I think it's a good medium, social media, to give hope to amputees and other people in similar situations.
Well, and it's so important because the reality is, you know, we have staff over Challenge Athletes Foundation. They can go visit people in the hospital. But if it's Travis Ricks, who's an above-knee amputee, or it's Donna Callahan, who's in a wheelchair, that makes an impact. That makes a difference because you guys have street cred, right? Hey, listen, this is what's going on. I know what you're going through because I've been there. That's essential.
Absolutely. And if he's quite, you know, you're in the hospital, you're going to ask me a question that you might not ask your doctor, something that you should ask, or even your parents, or, you know, when you kind of open up and these questions, like, a lot of the questions are everybody's got the same concern, it's just these human traits. It's very universal, and it doesn't matter whether, you know, you're white, black, male, female, what country you live in, everybody's got the same, sort of the same wishes, same concerns, and it feels good to help others, and then, you know, a year later, 2, 3, 4 years later, seeing them on a bicycle or running, you know, running to the hills with their prosthetic. And, I love that kind of stuff.
So what's out there that you haven't done that you want to do?
That's a good question. I would love to do a full triathlon one day.
I'm your guy.
You're my guy.
You want to do an Ironman one day? Or a triathlon.
I would love to at least train for one at some point in my life, and just, you know, that's the ultimate challenge. It really is.
You let me know when you're ready, because we'll set that up with the Ironman folks. I think they would absolutely love that. So you've been connected with Challenge Athletes Foundation for a little while. What have your impressions been, and what has Challenge Athletes Foundation meant not only to you but to the amputee community?
I think that term life changing gets thrown around quite a bit, and I would say 100% without a doubt that CAF, Challenge Athletes Foundation, is changing lives through, you know, we have such a, in a way it's a bit messed up, our, you know, the whole medical insurance and not being able to get what you want for sports, and, you know, if you want a surfing prosthetic, that how difficult that is, or a running prosthetic, and we know that sports and being active, it's such a preventive way to, you know, not have these chronic illnesses later in life, and that's a burden our healthcare system. And it's such a win-win for both the athlete and the rest of the general population. And I get maybe 2-3 times a week somebody messaging me, I want to get into running, I want to get into surfing so bad, and I see these pictures, and my insurance won't cover it. Where do I go? What do I do? And I refer them to you guys, and you guys really are changing life. I mean, it's incredible, and you know, look around at the World Adaptive Surfing Contest, and you've got guys from every corner of the earth, and half of them are there because of you, and because of the good work you guys are doing. And I you know, it's one of those things. You guys really are changing lives.
I love it. Well, and Mike, having partners like you who are able to be such great role models, really.
You guys are such forward-thinking people, and really, you know, almost like to the personal touch. Everything has a personal touch to it, and it's not just here's a leg, do that. You know, it's everything has got a really warm, I'd say almost aloha spirit to it, and I love it.
I love it. Hey, Mike, so great to have you part of the CAF family. Really, really love it. And so down the line, goals, obviously adaptive surfing, world. Now, did you win the world championships?
I got second this year,
and it was really close, right? It was really close.
Half a point, but it was really fun, and it was nice that my family was there, as you met my parents.
Yes,
also,
they're the best.
We had a little bit of swell. You could hear, you know, your scores in real time as you're in the water in the final heat. So the tide was really low, so the spectators were really close to the lineup. So you could feel that energy of everybody there, and it was palpable. It was incredible. And I think we're just going to build every year on a bigger and better and more and more competitors and more, you know, just more fun.
The coolest thing about that is in past years, you might have a competition like that and you're the only guy in your division, right?
Yep.
When you win, but who cares, right? At the end of the day, you know you didn't beat anybody. You were the only guy. Now you get out there and you have a battle like that. That's where the juices start flowing, because now it's, that guy beat me by, you know, half of a point. I'm going to go back and I'm going to go get that title next time. So it sort of fires you up a little bit.
Absolutely. And because it's a multi-day event and you start in round one, then you go to round two, and then you're in quarters, you know, and you kind of build up on this day by day by day. Early on, you're like, okay, I'm just here to have fun. And then, you know, you're like, I made it this far, I'm winning this thing.
Exactly. It becomes competitive, which is what it's all about.
Yeah,
I remember Rudy Garcia Tolson's our double above knee kid we've been working with since he was 6-7 years old. And the reality was, he couldn't compete in the Paralympics until there were athletes with his same disability around the world. So, you know, on one hand, he needs to find people who can kick his ass, because otherwise they're not going to be able to go to Paralympics. So it's that, you know, it's sort of hand in glove. You guys need each other, but it shows the world this is a real sport. This is competition, and it's two people. And forget the challenge or disability. It's two people who want to kick the other guy's butt. Period. End of story.
Yep.
Love that. Hey, Mike, thank you so much for taking so much time. Always a pleasure to get to chat with you. And hopefully we'll see you if, you know, what would be good is next year, if you're in Kona during Ironman week, you should come. I mean, if you're in Hawaii during Ironman week, you should come over and come watch the race.
Absolutely. Consider it done.
All right. We'll make that happen. That would be really fun.
Out and meet people, and
love it. Mike Coots has been our guest. Again, we are brought to you by the Tough Man Triathlon Series, by VeloFix.com, RunCatalina.com, Catalina Marathon, the 40th anniversary coming up on Saturday, March 11th. The Challenged Athletes Foundation. We've raised over $80 million to keep challenged athletes in the game of life through sport. Check us out on iTunes, on Babbittville.com. Subscribe to the Endurance World newsletter. And as always, endurance lives here.